If you look up that album, Maddy Pryor, Off of the King, and look for lyrics on the internet, you'll find the lyrics too.
Mm.
Which will help. And then the lyrics aren't always easy to hear at the end of the year. Okay. So, let's come back to our good friend Geoffrey of Monmouth and Arthur. And let's talk a little bit more about what is Arthur about and what is this idea of the once and the future king. And I think one of the things that's just worth saying, first of all, really, is that we have to remember that, you know, this Geoffrey of Monmouth's version of Arthur is the earliest written version of Arthur we have. It's different from some of the later versions, and I'll talk about that in just a second. But this very early comment that we have in the Gododdin, when they say about a warrior, he was a great warrior, but he was no Arthur, really suggests very clearly that Arthur was a very central figure in British understanding at that time. Because to say somebody is no Arthur means that, oh, well, we all know what that meant by that.
And,
yeah, exactly. It's like no Winston Churchill, exactly. So everybody knows that who Arthur is and why Arthur is the way he is, and though somebody might be a great warrior, well, still not a patch on Arthur, chaps, is he?
And when was the Gododdin?
The Gododdin, fifth century. Right, so very early. Right, so Geoffrey were in the 12th century, Mabinogion were in the 13th century. But one of the things, we're talking about timelines earlier, one of the things that kind of muddled the timelines and why people get very confused about Arthur and these things is that because the Mabinogi does actually, I think, could genuinely contain some very ancient stories and images. People have assumed, and certainly many neo-pagans have assumed, that the Mabinogi is a very ancient Welsh book. I mean, generally speaking, if you ask most people, they would say, "Oh no, this is the most ancient kind of literature," and I think they would assume it is equivalent to the time of the Gododdin. And of course, there was a time when people did think the Mabinogi was that old. The reason we know we can sense it's old is because it retains a lot of the oral tale telling tropes, really, of elaborate description and the kind of thing that storytellers use to kind of remind themselves of the nature of the story. And so you get elaborate images in a way that are described in immense kind of detail. Which is you get less of, and you don't really get that in Geoffrey and in the later literature in the same way. But nonetheless, the thing about the Mabinogi, it is later, not just later than Geoffrey of Monmouth, it's later than the writings of somebody called Robert de Biron and a lot of the French literature that comes out about Arthur. And one of the things that you have to bear in mind when you're looking at the Mabinogi is how influenced it has been by the later literature. Even the Four Branches, because the Four Branches are put together by a brilliant storyteller. I hope the Princess of David, I think it is, but I don't know. And so, unlike the kind of pagan revival thing which says these are the ancient Welsh gods and goddesses, well, they're not. They're still important, powerful images that connect us to things. They're aspects of the secondary imagination that we were looking at earlier. So it's not at all saying that they're useless or false or anything like that. But when we look at the figure of Arthur, when we look at the way the story has evolved, we know, one of the things we just know from that fragment in the Gododdin is that he will have been a very important figure in storytelling. Very important. People will have known, certainly Welsh culture, people will have known who Arthur was. You find a couple of references in the Welsh triads to him, and you find reference to him in a couple of places in the poems of Taliesin. And I'm not going to do too much on this, but I'll just read you this poem called The Prithai Anuvin. I'm not going to explain it too much because I once ran a 2-year course on trying to explain this poem.
So it also references Puth and Pryderi from the four branches of the first.
It does.
Mm. So,
yeah. So there's a link right between them all. Mm. So these are the kind of, if we think the Gododdin is one, this is another very early poem, again, maybe 5th, 6th century. I won't bother reading in Welsh because that is no point, is it, really? So I'll read it in English. I praise the sovereign, high prince of the kingly land, who encompasses the margins of the world. Gwaith's captivity in Cawsiddi is resonant with the tale of Poeth and Pryderi. None before him was sent into it, into the heavy blue chain that bound the faithful youth. You may remember the blessed youth, the faithful youth that we've been dealing with. Because of the raid upon Anuvin, he sorely sang. Until the world's ending, our poet's prayer shall sound. 3 ship burdens of Prudwin entered within. Now Prudwin is Arthur's ship, also his shield. Come back to that. Except 7, none rose up from Cawsiddi, but from 7, none returned from the castle of the mound. I am renowned in fame. The song is heard in Caerpadevran, 4 times revolving. My original song stems from the cauldron. By the breath of 9 maidens it is kindled. The chief of Anuvin's cauldron, what is its power? Ridged with enamel, rimmed with pearl. It will not boil, the coward's portion. The sword of Chewak flashes before it, and in the hand of Chemwynach is it wielded. Chemwynach is the leaper. Before hell's gates, lights are burning. When with Arthur we went to the harrowing, except 7, none rose up from Carveduit, but for 7, none returned from the castle of the Hallows. I am renowned in fame. The song is heard in the 4-score fort, in the island of the flaming door. Fresh water and jet are mixed. There's a medieval belief. If you put jet together with fresh water, there will be an explosion of light. Bright wine is the drink served to the host. 3 ship burdens is the drink served. Bright wine is the drink served to the host. 3 ship burdens of Prudwin we took to sea. Except 7, none rose up from Carrigar. Except for 7, none rose up from the royal castle. I give no reward to the lord's bookmen who beyond Cae Widre saw not Arthur's valour. Widre means the glass castle. 6,000 men there stood upon the wall. Hard it is to parley with a sentinel. 3 ship burdens of Prudwin we went with Arthur. Except 7, none rose up from Cae Gulydd. But for 7, none returned from the castle of the wall. I give no reward to the clerics with trailing shields, who know not who created who, nor the hour when the chick is born. Who made him? Why he went not to the meadows of Devwy? They know not whose the brindle locks thick his headband, with 7 score links upon his collar, when we went with Arthur on arduous exhibition. Except 7, none rose up from Carvandwy. But for 7, none returned from the castle of the High One. I give no reward to the clerics of weak intent, who know not on what day the chief is made, who do not know the hour of his birth, nor what silver-headed beast they guard. When we went with Arthur, disastrous contention. Except 7, none rose up from Cae Ochrin. But for 7, none returned from the castle of the keys. Monks howl like a choir of dogs from a contest with the men who know. Does the wind have one track? Is the sea one water? Is fire one single spark of fierce tumult? Monks crowd together like wolves from a contest with men who know. They know not the divisions of midnight or dawn, unknowing of the wind's course, what's its attack, where it ravages, what land it strikes. The saint's grave lies hidden deep in the ground. I praise the sovereign, the great high prince. May sadness leave me. Christ is my protector. So that gives us an image of Arthur as this figure making a great raid upon the other world to gain the otherworldly treasures in his ship Prudwin. And there's a lot, enormous amount of meaning in this poem, which I'll come back to next time. But for our purposes right now, the importance is to recognize this early poem very firmly speaks of Arthur as this sort of magical figure in his ship Prudwin, making the raid upon the other world. And there is a connection here with the history of Poeth and Pryderi. Now, Pryderi is a figure is a blessed youth. We have the sense of the prisoner whose song is heard until the end of the world. And we have this idea of the mystery and the quest is because of the... I'll just read that bit again. This is just a really interesting bit. I'll try not to get into explaining too much because we'd be here forever. But the... So because of the raid upon... into the heavy blue chain that bound the faithful youth. And this is a figure called Gwair, whose captivity is resonant with the tale of Poeth and Pryderi. And Pryderi is the child of light. He sings because of the raid upon Anuvin, but the raid upon Anuvin, which is partly to rescue and to find the blessed child. So you can hear that kind of call and response, this kind of conversation, right? This deep kind of conversation. And in a certain sense, as the magical youth, the magical child is retrieved, what comes with the magical child are the treasures of the deep which redeem the land. So there's a whole kind of layers and layers of meaning there, which I'm going to look at next weekend.
Like William Rees's. Mm-hmm. Well, like William Rees's before Vortigern, who knows where to look.
Yeah.
Well, yes, Taliesin is the narrator. Yeah. Oh, so these are one of the poems of Taliesin. So Taliesin is the narrator, is the witness, is the, because he is the archetypal bard, he is the rememberer and the speaker to us. Mm-hmm. And Taliesin, of course, himself is a magical child. Remember the history of Taliesin. He is this child who is first of all his little Gwion, and who tends the cauldron of Ceridwen, the goddess, who gathers together the essence of everything in the world, and it boils it all down into these three golden drops which he receives. So he is, and then there's this extraordinary chase sequence of transformations, mm. where he has the first of all the birth and death of the cauldron, birth and death in the womb of Ceridwen, and finally the birth, and he is born and dies by going into the great sea and coming eventually to shore in Gwynedd. So he is this figure that is continually kind of transformed, and he, in this instance, he is speaking about, and in fact in the poem, there's two Taliesins really in Welsh tradition. There's an actual bard figure who does what the bards need. They tells how generous and great his patron is. But he's probably an actual figure. But there is a mythic Taliesin who is really the rememberer of Welsh tradition, and you find him in the history of Taliesin. You also find him in the series of legendary poems from the Book of Taliesin. I'm just going to read you another one of these poems.
Yeah. So just the magical youth that corresponds directly to the imprisoned youth in Culloch and Olwyn.
Yeah.
That gets rescued.
Yeah. Well, yes, and there it's even more interesting, because the Mabon, so we have the Mabon who is imprisoned up in Gloucester, in a place in Gloucester, so they have to go up the Severn to rescue him. That's a whole other story. But one of the, but of course, the whole of the story of Culloch and Olwyn is about the emergence of the son and the daughter of light, and their union together. And so there's a whole lot more in there. But let's just find the. Bear with me. I just want to find. Where are we? Cut it tightly on. There's a poem called Cadav Tyrion, which is the chair of Tyrion's chair, which talks about a great leader, and really this is about a reference to Arthur. It kind of goes a bit like this. It starts off very modestly. Here is a declamation of a brilliant poem of immeasurable inspiration concerning a man, a brave, authoritative one, from the stock of Aladar. Is he a famous one, a wise man, or the ruler of Rayon? Or is he a royal ruler with his reverence of scripture, and his red armour, and his host attacking over the rampart, and his measured song in the midst of a lordly warband? He bore off from Carvnir pale harnessed horses, the venerable Tyrion, the Fatina, Hylin, and the third profound song of the sage. This was sung in order to bless Arthur. Arthur has been blessed in harmonious song as a defence in battle, trampling nine at a time. Who were the three stewards who guarded the country? Who were the three knowing ones who guarded the sign? Who will come as desired to meet their lord? Splendid is the virtue of the fortification. Splendid is the lively presence of a fine man. Splendid is a freely circulating drinking horn. Splendid a castle resting at noon. Splendid is the true God when he shines forth. More splendid still when he pronounces. Splendid was it when they animated from him the sovereign cauldron. The Ogwairion, the Gwairion is the magical hag. The Aquarion, the goddess, we could say, of triune, of threefold inspiration. I have been a torch lord with a horn in my hand. He doesn't deserve a chair who doesn't conserve my words, my brilliant contest song of fluent and confident inspiration. Tell me, what are the names of the three fortresses between the sea flood and the low water? He was not ardent, doesn't know. There are four fortresses in the havens of Britain. Tumult of lords. Since it may not be, it shan't be. It shan't be, since it may not be. There will be fleets as the waves washes over the shingle. Certain it is to be the realm of the sea. Neither slopes nor a sheltered spot, nor hill nor hollow, nor a covering from the storm will there be in the face of the angry wind. The song of Tyrion, may it be the skilful poet who perpetuates it. Igno will be sought, Kedig will be sought, because our soldiers are bereft. I assume a sad manner as a result of the annihilation of the Lord with a fiery nature. With the breastplate of Clion, there shall arise a ruler, a Gwledig, for the fierce wealthy ones. There'll be a dispersal of the foaming head of the braggart, evanescent by nature, and a spate of wounding on the contested border. The foreign peoples are a fast flood of sea voyagers from the stock of the seraphim. They are from the evil lot of the abyss. Let us go and release Elphin. Elphin in the story of Taliesin is his kind of patron. And you know, it's not like much to Taliesin's poems. It's not exactly kind of clear, but you can hear that they what's being, you can hear the centrality of Arthur, and then there's these kind of riddling kind of poems. So in a certain sense, we'll come back to some of these in more detail next time, really look at what the bards are meaning. But what you can see is then that this much earlier time, Arthur is this kind of numinous sort of presence. Different presence from the courtly king that we later come across, and in a sense, Geoffrey's work is a sort of translation of that this ancient figure, which is why he says, you know, it's the Archdeacon Walter who has this Welsh book, so he's translating some of these ideas into things that the Norman aristocracy can understand. And so when we come to his account of Arthur, what you find is there are some things that are kind of quite different from the a common understanding. But before I come to that, there's a little just before we come to the because in the history of Merlin. And the prophecies of Merlin, we get this whole business of Vortigern and the Saxons. And the Saxons are beaten back by two figures called Ambrosius Aurelianus and Uther Pendragon. Uther being, you know, Arthur's father. And Ambrosius is the senior of the two, really, and so they get rid of Vortigern, they re-establish balance and harmony. And then there's this powerful thing that happens, where we're back with the giants in a bit, really, because one of the things the Saxons did was to slaughter some of the finest of the British leadership and the British churchmen, and they were buried by a monastery near Amesbury, and the Ambrosius Aurelianus wants there to be a great memento, a great memorial around their burial mound. And he has heard of the Ring of the Giants, which is in Ireland, which effectively is Stonehenge, that he believes the giants set up in Ireland. And Merlin goes to get Stonehenge. And to bring it over to Salisbury, and to establish it around the ring of the ancient dead, around the tumulus of the tomb of the ancient dead. Now, almost certainly, this is a folk memory of the blue stones coming from Preseli's in Wales, not Ireland, but coming from Wales, all the way down to Salisbury Plain. And the sense of Merlin as a magical person, because surely only a magical person could have done this. So Merlin is sort of linked really with the establishment of this. Now there's a wonderful book by Nikolai Tolstoy about the mythical foundation of Stonehenge. I can't remember the name. I'll send you the details of it later on tonight. If you're interested, but be warned, very dense.
Becoming the King. Where he uses just about every Welsh.
Yes, that's the novel, Becoming of the King. Yeah, it's brilliant. I love Nicola Johnson's work. He wrote an extraordinary novel called The Becoming of the King, which I absolutely love. And I'm really sad he only wrote the one because he was going to go on, but he ran out. Not surprised he ran out of steam. It's a massive book. But yes, he was definitely a possible source, you could imagine. And his writing is very... He wrote another book called The Quest for Merlin, which again is very, very good, but very dense. And he wrote a third one about... I just can't remember the name at the moment. But it's about Stonehenge. And it's about Stonehenge as representing the centre of Britain, the Umphalos of Britain, like Delphi is the Umphalos, or the centre stone of Greece. As they're saying, Stonehenge is the centre stone of Britain. It's a very good book, but it does go into things in horrendous detail. So you have to be up to my level of obsessiveness around this stuff to find it of use, really. So feel free to pass on it if you don't want to go into that kind of detail. But what is interesting about Geoffrey's account of that is this is the place where first then Ambrosius is buried, and then Uther later is buried. And so there is something about this is the sacred enclosure where the high kings are buried. You know, so there's something about Stonehenge. It's a bit unclear with Geoffrey whether he understood the difference between Stonehenge and Avebury. So some of the way he writes it, you're not sure. Is he talking about, are we talking about Avebury here? Are we talking about Stonehenge? But Stonehenge is probably the place, but there's a bit of dispute about that. So, we get the story that carries on from that is a bit similar to Mallory's in that we have Uther wanting a grain and Merlin using his magic, or Geoffrey in a rather more pragmatic way. I have these wonderful drugs which will disguise you and put the semblance of Gorlice upon you. So I'll give you these drugs and you'll be fine. So that bit is just as we remember it. So this happens. But the place where Arthur is given away to another family is not found in Geoffrey of Monmouth. It happens later on with Robert de Baron. So what we have with Arthur dies, and he's just succeeded by Arthur, who is his acknowledged son. And the in the Mallory, it's these various people from the north who are attacking. In Geoffrey of Monmouth, it's the continuing battle with the Saxons, and they say Uther Pendragon being dead, the mobility from several provinces assembled together at Silchestre and proposed to Duprecius, the Archbishop of the town of the Legions, they should consecrate Arthur, Uther's son, to be their king. For they were now in great straits, because upon hearing of the king's death, the Saxons had invited over their countrymen from Germany, and under the command of Colbrim were attempting to exterminate the whole British race. Arthur was then 15, so that Duprecius then, with the other bishops, sets the crown upon Arthur's head. He was then but 15 years old, but a youth of unparalleled courage and generosity, joined with that sweetness of temper and innate goodness, has gained him universal love. And he's seen as being this generous giver, and he becomes the war leader, really, and he marches north, and he meets with a great army composed of Saxons, Scots, and Picts by the River Douglas, and a great battle happens, he beats them, pursues Colgan to York, and then besieges him, and so there's a whole kind of whole series of battles, which we need to not go into all the details of, but this is the battles really, so between him and the Saxons. But even within that, there's some kind of quite magical kind of images, really. So the place where he goes to relieve the city of Lincoln, being situated on a mountain between two rivers, and as they arrived with all their forces, they fought with the Saxons and made a great slaughter of them between the rivers, and chased them until they come to the wood of Caledon. And then there's a whole thing about working with the energies of the wood of Caledon and then defeating the Saxons and driving them out. And then they having driven them out, what happens is they promised that he's very down on the Saxons in this book, because he's talking to the Normans, who think of themselves, the Saxons are troublesome too, so you get a lot of trouble, you know. So the lying Saxons, having agreed to go home, tack about towards Britain and go to shore at Totnes, which is, of course, the beginning point of Britain. So the treacherous Saxons then go to shore and then attack and then lay siege to Bath. And so they segue around from that. And the and Arthur has to march back here and comes to Somerset and says to him, addresses himself to his followers in these words: "Since these impious and detestable Saxons have disdained to make faith with me, I, to keep faith with God, will endeavour to revenge the blood of my countrymen this day upon them. To arms, soldiers, to arms! Courageously fall upon the perfidious wretches, over whom we shall, with Christ assisting us, undoubtedly obtain the victory." And we get this great kind of description of Arthur, really, because of just before the battle, where he says he puts on a coat of mail suitable to the grandeur of so powerful a king, places a golden helmet upon his head, on which is engraven the figure of a dragon. On his shoulders, his shield is called Prydwen. Now, this is a shift, really. In the older traditions, his ship is Prydwen. Now we're calling his shield Prydwen. Now, this is the sense of Prydwen, which name means the white... does Prydwen mean white? What's the Pry mean? Prid. It does mean white ship, actually. There must be a sort of lack of translation. So it does mean white ship, Prydwen. But it's a holy ship. There's a sort of mythical shift in that, because a ship is the container that enables to keep yourself safe. It's a sort of a holding place. And likewise, a shield is something that protects and holds you. And his shield has the picture of the Blessed Mary, Mother of God, painted upon it, in order to put him frequently in mind of her. So this sort of ancient mythic image we get from Brutus of the goddess echoing down. So we get him with the dragon, with the sort of a golden helmet with the dragon. We've got this shield, really, that bears the image of the Virgin. He girds on Caliban, which is his sword. It's made in the Isle of Avalon, and he's got his magical lance called Ron. Not such a magical name, but in Erdine, who knows? And this Ron is hard and broad and fit for slaughter. And then there's a sort of a great. So then we have a great kind of battle. And in that battle, he draws out Caliban, calls upon the name of the Virgin, and goes into the thick of the fight and kills, until, you know, 470. This is obviously there are older legends about Arthur as a great warrior and a killer of men. In fact, it's the Welsh Triad that talks about the three red ravages of Britain, which ends in saying, "And Arthur himself was the greatest ravager of all." So that sense of Arthur himself being this great warrior who pursues the Saxons and drives them out. So this is something that then goes on and on and on. So mainly this is like much of the stories of Arthur, there's a lot about the battles, which is all about establishing peace and harmony through war. But there's a little segue where Arthur talks about the magical nature of ponds. And then we have him establishing peace.
P-O-N-D-S.
Yes, P-O-N-D-S. Yeah. Ponds, lakes. Ponds and lakes. He talks about magical lakes for a bit. So he beats the Scots as well. So we see him establishing, in a sense, the sense of order and peace throughout England. And then the key piece at length, when the whole country is reduced by him to its ancient state, So therefore, when he has restored everything into its ancient state before the barbaric incursions. So the point of all this slaughter and battle and all of that has been to restore the balance. And at that point he then takes to wife a person who will later call Guinevere, of course, but here is called Guanhumara, descended from a noble family of Romans whose beauty surpassed all the women of the island. So then this queen, then he gathers his queen. What he next does, and this is interesting, he's really now playing to the Normans, because of course the Normans are extending their dynasty right across Europe. So Arthur adds to his government Iceland, Gothland, and the Orkneys. So followed by Norway, Dacia, Aquitaine, and Gaul. So then, he keeps on, he's established, he just keeps on going, really. And there's a whole interesting thing that, so I'm going to go into all of that, there's an important piece at one point where he talks about he bestows Nestria, now called Normandy, upon Bedivere, his butler. So he's explicitly linking Normandy with the Arthurian mythos, and Bedivere is one of the knights who is kind of closest to him. And what he does then is to create peace around Europe, but they're all subservient to him. And what he then does is at the Feast of Pentecost is to summon all the many kings and princes and archbishops to a solemn assembly at the City of the Legions. The City of the Legions is Siren System, it's Carinium. So it's just that place where he just gathers them all. It's Caleon, I beg your pardon, it's Caleon, it's the City of the Legions. So the people are gathered. So they're gathered to Caleon to do, and they're on, and so they're from everywhere, everywhere. And it's that point that he gets crowned again as High King, there's odd little things really. As soon as the king was invested with his royal habiliments, he was conducted in great pomp to the Metropolitan Church, supported on each side by two archbishops, and having four kings of Albania, Cornwall, Dalmatia, and Venedotia, whose right it was, bearing four golden swords before him. So here's the fifth point, with the four kings on either side of him, with two archbishops supporting them. In another part is the queen, dressed out in her richest ornaments, conducted by the archbishops and bishops to the Temple of the Virgins. She is also surrounded by four queens, bearing before her four white doves, according to ancient customs. And there's an interesting piece where happens. But then she goes to one palace with them. He goes to one palace with the men. She goes to another with the women. For the Britons still observe the ancient custom of Troy, in which men and women used to celebrate their festivals apart. So again, there's a reference back to Troy, and we're just shown this enormous sort of magnificence, really, that of riches and kinds of so it's, everything's going swimmingly well. Until the Roman Emperor Lucius Tiberius has the audacity to challenge Arthur. And then Arthur goes to war with Rome because he refuses to pay tribute to the Romans. In the meantime, killing a giant. But So while he's off pursuing his wars in Rome, he gives Modred, who is not his son but his nephew in this story, so gives governance of Britain to Modred and Guanhumara. And the and while he's there's, he has a dream where he falls into a sound sleep, and in the dream he sees the bear flying in the air at a noise of which all shores trembled. Also a terrible dragon flying from the west, which enlightened the country with the brightness of its eyes. When these two met, they began a dreadful fight. But the dragon with its fiery breath burned the bear, which often assaulted him, and threw him down, scorched to the ground. Arthur, upon his awakening, related his dream, and they took it upon themselves to interpret it, and told him that the dragon signified himself, that the bear some giant that would contend with him, and the dragon's victory would be the same that happened to himself. Now, of course, what we know about Arthur is the bear king, and so his advisers are misleading him at this point. So then and this is actually a sort of description of what happens between him and Mordred and Gwenhamra later. So then he kills a giant, and that's a sort of a reference back to the Trojans, and it's saying that he is this figure as mighty and as powerful as the most ancient ancestors. He then conquers Rome, and Rome then becomes and kills Lucius Tiberius. And the British achieves victory. Part of them run away, the rest surrender themselves to becoming slaves. And so this is a huge kind of powerful flip over. If you remember that in Romano-Celtic society, the Romans are in charge. So this is Geoffrey saying, now the Britons have become so mighty now that they've assumed the British Empire, they've assumed the Roman Empire. But the key thing that happens, really, which is the while he's away doing all this, his queen gets together with Mordred. There's no Lancelot in this story. There's no kind of so the her betrayal is to get together with Mordred, and the you know it's Mordred in a sense who in the vision is the dragon, and so you get this enormous kind of battle. Where Mordred is killed, but Arthur is wounded to death. Guinevere goes to Amesbury and becomes a nun, and we're told that he is carried surrenders the crown to Constantine, son of Cador, the Duke of Cornwall. In the 542nd year of our Lord's incarnation, and he gives up, but he is carried thence to the Isle of Avalon to be cured of his wounds, and then that's the last we hear of him. And Geoffrey's gone and gone. Now, one of the things we might kind of notice really is that the difference is there's no. Sword coming out of the stone. The youth doesn't have to kind of prove himself. Now that's a creative, and in some ways quite magical interpretation that happens later on. Comes out of the writings of Robert de Baron, which is around about so Geoffrey is writing about 1120, we think, towards about the end of the 12th century. Robert de Baron starts to write his two works, Joseph of Arimathea and Merlin, and it's in these writings that we first find the idea of Arthur, the beginnings of the story of Arthur as we know it. But if you look at the story, if you stay with Geoffrey for this weekend, we'll come back to the others later. It's a straightforward story in some ways, right? and it's a story of this great leader who is magically conceived, and Merlin has this great hand in it, and whose task it is to establish order and sovereignty, and who, like Brutus, is a servant of the goddess, who is a so he is a, the, if you like the servant of the goddess. His role is to establish re-establish the ancient order of the land. And that there's a certain amount of grandstanding, and that it isn't just that. He then, not only does he establish it, that order in Britain, he establishes it in across Europe. He effectively becomes the imperator, because he killed the Roman emperor, and he and we have this place where he's turned the tables on the Romans. But in actual fact, one of the interesting things you get that's always there in the story of Arthur is he takes his eye off the main event. So somewhere the sense of the betrayal that happens to Arthur by not attending to things, and that kind of, and in Malory, what happens, of course, is that Mordred, you know, but it's more powerfully stressed in Malory, in Robert Burrow, in the later stories, particularly in Malory, where his an inattentiveness to Guinevere enables really the relationship with Lancelot. His ability to be seduced by Morgause, who literally creates Mordred, who is his nemesis, creates a situation where he has not properly paid attention. For all his successes, there is a flaw, a fatal flaw somewhere in him, where he, and so his kingdom does not last. So in all the versions of the story, you get this period of harmony and blessedness, and then you get this place of destruction, place of things coming to an end. I mean, Malory has this great phrase, really, it's oddly similar to the situation we find ourselves when the populace all vote for Mordred, and they flock under Mordred's banner. And you know, Mordred is the wicked king who is no for anybody other than himself. But the people support him because they are so newfangled and not connected to the deeper traditions. And in a certain sense, that image of the people being newfangled, not rooted in their own sovereignty, takes us into this place where this sort of magical story and this extraordinary king who, because if we look more, you know, not to get into too much detail about the battles and being a great warrior, but what we see is he takes up the work of his father and his uncle Ambrosius, which is about, and so if we imagine a place without any order, and where there is no safety for anybody, and where people, just the strongest, do whatever they like, and there is ruin everywhere, just as we saw in that kind of that Saxon poem of the ruin of Bath. So and the sense of something beautiful having been destroyed, and the longing for order, for harmony, for balance, and the return of civilization. In some ways, you could say the return of hot water. The simplicity of hot water. Right? But if you haven't got hot water, particularly hot water on tap even, maybe, you know, or warmth, or windows that you can look through, or not having to be struggling to survive at every moment. So in a certain sense, what he represents is that desire, that sovereign desire for that kind of harmony that lets us do other things than simply fighting each other to survive. Mm. And in a way, that's the thing that runs all the way through, right from the beginning. You know, the battles are, Arthur's role is not principally that of an invader, although Geoffrey Fallagher's of the Norman expansion, and Arthur's, sort of the Arthur's main role is to be the centre point, who sends troops, knights out, and you certainly see this in Malory, where you see the knights being sent out. Arthur is at the centre point, and he gathers everything in. The robber knights are brought back, they swear fealty to Arthur, and little by little you see order spreading out from that simplest, that single point of sovereignty. So where this applies in our own life and in our own time is as we enter into our own sovereignty, as we enter into the sense of Anokhi and this kind of, this axis point, and enter into conversation with the universe, with all aspects of the universe, as we start to participate in the living conversation, what starts to happen is a deeper sense of order and harmony starts to emerge. Now, some of the conversations are very difficult conversations. You know, there's a line in the Pradhyanavan where it says, hard it is to speak to the sentinel. And one of the castles, called the Castle of the Wall, is also called the Castle of Digestion, because the conversation with the sentinel of Kaggolith is a long one that has to be digested little by little by little. So some of the conversations we have with aspects of the universe, or even aspects of ourselves, are long, slow, difficult conversations. Just sometimes why the link with the giants helps us feel strongly rooted enough to have these slow, unfolding conversations. And I, in the break, so I was just looking at the emails, I came across a comment by somebody, which I think is true, I think he's a reliable person, who's saying, yes, it's terrible that Reform won all these seats. However, if you think of the number of councillors in England, only 5% of them are Reform. And in a way, that kind of wider, slower, okay, yes, okay, come back to the centre point, come back to the axis point, because the problem is if we lose our sense of centre, if we lose that sense of Anokhi and that sense of dynamic balance, we then become lost in a version of the internal dialogue from the past, subject really to the, if you like, our own barbarians. Our own, the people, the energies, the things that have frightened us as babies and children, the monsters, then have free reign within us and within the world. If we align ourselves with that sense of sovereignty that Arthur represents, we come into centre point, not perfectly, and actually the thing that's very helpful for me around the Arthur story is that he's a flawed character, so we're not required to be perfect. We're required to keep trying to return ourselves to the centre point from which the ripples of harmony come. And to remember the deeper conversation, the conversation that is the conversation of healing and not the conversation of wounding. And like Arthur, we will lose awareness of this. And like Arthur, we will have to deal with the consequences of this. But the thing that's interesting as well about Arthur is that he does not die. The king that was, that is, that will come again. So even in this very straightforward telling of the story, Geoffrey says, well, he goes off to Avalon, of course. He doesn't die. But he is somewhere in Avalon. And Avalon is this mystical place, and we hear more about Avalon in Geoffrey Mumm's Life of Merlin, where we're told that Avalon is this magical place governed by the Nine Sisters, of which Morgan is the chief. Now Morgan in Geoffrey is not the later Morgan who is trying to subvert Arthur. She is this magical shape-shifting woman who is a great healer. And we learned from Geoffrey that it's from Avalon that he sent his sword, his great sword, Caliburn. And it is to Morgan and the sisters and the nine sisters, who are the same nine sisters we find in Prydeanaven, whose breath warms the cauldron, who take care of him until it's time for him to come again.
There's an archetypal author, and then there's the author of the story. It's like his purpose and his potential and what he represents is stronger than he is.
Yeah.
And he's actually quite... Well, I don't like to think about anyone, but he's kind of like weak as a king, you know, doesn't seem to make any decisions, really, or... kind of, like you say, takes a side for the ball quite a lot, or kind of sort of seems a bit lost, really. He's not someone with a sort of confident sense of, this is my purpose.
Well, he isn't Geoffrey. He's got a bit of a flaw around relationship. Geoffrey has.
Mm.
Right, so it's in the later traditions about him that he doesn't really have much of... that we see him just sort of sitting there while everything happens around him. Now, in Geoffrey Monmouth, he is this great conqueror, he's very like Alexander the Great, right? So he leads everything, he controls it, but he has a flaw in that he trusts people, that he trusts his wife and his queen and Mordred, whom we shouldn't have trusted. And then he swings back and he defeats Mordred. So the character of Arthur we get in Geoffrey is really kind of quite different from the figure we later get in the later romances and stories. Because yes, you're completely right. In the later, he doesn't seem to do much. Well, he establishes himself. He sees them off initially, and then he just seems to sit there, watching everything happen around him. That's a sort of it's a curious thing, that actually, and it's like some of the later chroniclers have in their need, and particularly with Malory, in their need to produce these powerful and interesting stories, and God knows I can understand Burrough Malory, because because the whole war with Rome goes on forever. And so eventually he just ends up sitting there because he's like done his wars. The thing that's particular about Arthur, I think, is the way he somehow is flawed in his relationship to the feminine principle. Mm-hmm. For all that he has here on his shield and he somehow cannot make the connection with Guinevere. He cannot hold something together. In Malory, it's seduction by Magoas, which gives place to the creation of Mordred. His inability to somehow meet Guinevere as she needs to be met creates an instability at the heart of the court. And there's something, the feeling you get, you certainly get this from Geoffrey of Monmouth as well, is he's this great war leader. Mm-hmm. But when we come to the sense of peace, he doesn't quite know what to do. He just can't quite do it. Mm-hmm. And becomes unstable in that place. You know, and there's a whole number of stories really about Arthur. Some you get from the Triad where he is a bit like Herod, and he's trying to exterminate Mordred, so he's lots and lots of infant children killed, and so he becomes a bit of a bard king and a sort of a, you know, and so he's this complex, flawed kind of character, and And in a way, the interesting thing I think about the Arthurian myths is because they have light and shadow in them. They're not simple myths, but the people make them simple. That's the danger with them in some ways, in that people get very nationalistic, always simplify things, and yes, you drive out the foreigner, or Serbia, drive out the Turk, or is actually the complexity of a character, ambiguous nature of a character like Arthur, raises these questions. That sense of confusion we feel when we think about him is an useful confusion. Because he's not simply a kind of a holy good figure, he's a weak figure. Sometimes he's a bit of a wicked figure, he does things that aren't very good, and he therefore acts as a bit of a mirror to these places in ourselves.
Is that kind of like massive conquest, kind of like the king of lots of... I sort of feel I want him to be more of a kind of protector than a...
Yes, totally, he overreaches himself. And in a way, I think that's kind of the point of this, is that he can't stop doing the conquering bit. Mm-hmm. Right, so instead of becoming then the centre point and the protector of order and just holding the boundaries and keeping Britain safe, he then keeps on going, even so that he has to... So instead of just protecting Britain against Rome, he goes off to conquer Rome and kills the emperor. So there's a way in which he's unbalanced. It's like Gebira without Gedila. He just keeps on going and sort of in the...
But this is the other thing his Norman patrons understand, isn't it? Because this is what they're doing. This is what they've done.
Well, this is the shadow. This is the shadow side of the. Because what Geoffrey is also doing is trying to please the Norman conquerors who are establishing themselves all over Europe, and that's partly where Geoffrey comes in on this. But I think there is something in that. Then it's a lesson to us, really, that you establish harmony. To establish harmony involves a certain amount of effort. A challenging of ourselves, a challenging of others, a creation of a pushing out of boundary. But you need to know where to stop and to contain and to then just be at peace with ourselves and the world. And that's the bit he doesn't do. In fact, he kind of, in a sense, you could say he abandons his wife, he abandons the rule of the country he's conquered and gives it over to Mordred, who doesn't want to give it back and takes everything from him in the end.
It's a great book title called Swimming with the Piranhas Makes You Hungry. It's that, once you start, enough will never be enough.
Yeah.
Like Trump,
Yeah.
Now he wants to be Alexander the Great.
Yeah.
Because the capitalist world says, go outwards and acquire more to be enough.
Yeah. No, and you see this, the fact you think of Alexander the Great. I mean, he's another figure that does this. He establishes this enormous, defeats the Persian Empire. He annexes Egypt. This is somebody coming out of the small country of Macedon. He can't contain himself. He thinks, I'll go and take India now. And of course dies because he's overreached himself.
There's never a period of consolidation with these people, is there?
No.
There's never a pull back and consolidate and think and just, it's just continuous.
Well, in that way then that sense of dynamic balance is lost. Right, so it's that kind of, you can't stop doing.
What? It's like Napoleon in Russia, isn't it?
Napoleon in Russia, another example, yes, totally. It's a sort of a... Hitler's another one. Hitler, so the continual need to push out, to push out, to push out, in the end destroys them.
Mm. There's something there for me about sitting in the centre. Like, this is the first time I've sat in this position in this room. So this symbol is like...
Yeah.
And the place of the centre being the gathering point to then decide on volition, to decide on the pathway.
Yeah.
And if you've been in the centre and you're still on the pathway and on it and on it and on it, and then that time of coming back into the centre again, it sometimes doesn't happen. And without that, you're devoid of the centre of the feminine principle.
Yes, that's right.
You're really living that racing sperm then.
Yeah.
Galloping along.
Constantly galloping along.
Yeah, but without the very thing that could actually propagate or generate.
Yes, that's right.
And I was thinking about that with the place of Guinevere and Arthur not having children.
Yeah.
It was like at the very centre, like if the heart is the very centre of the living flame, but then there's something about the marriage bed as being the living flame of the lineage forward. You know, that never happens either. So there's a neglect at that central space of the masculine with that really comes together.
Yeah. So there's a profound imbalance there somewhere, isn't there? And I think that's yeah, so that's, you know, and in a way that's the part of the point of the whole Arthurian story is to show both sides, to show the light and the shadow, and to act as a mirror to us where we are able to work with our shadows. You know, it really helps us look at our shadow side. So to look at the places inside ourselves that just try to keep going, rather than being with the mystery of moving from the generative masculine into the holding quality of the feminine principle, and vice versa. You know, so that kind of interplay. You know, which keeps us centered and generative, but not overextending ourselves. And in a way, balance is like this, isn't it? I mean, that place of the things that my Tai Chi practice teaches me, if I overextend myself, I'm in great danger of falling over. Because, you know, when you practice Tai Chi, you move from one side to another side, front and back. There's always an opposing motion. So you're working all the time around an unfolding center point. And you have to be both rooted in the earth and rooted in the sky, and this is a practice where you kind of visualize yourself rooting down into the earth and your head aligned with the pole star, so that as you practice the Tai Chi ritual, you are working with space, you're working with the earth, you're working with the sky, you're working with a direction to space. And your job at all times is to try and to keep that connection while moving in different into different spaces and creating different shapes.
I was talking about to join in a little bit, like habit.
Yeah.
That could be a part of this too, because if you're used to going, Alexander the Great, you get into a habit of doing that, and actually to come back.
No, it's hard. It's very difficult because you've got the momentum of the habit to work with, haven't you? And then you've got the thing that caused the habit, which is this survival energy. This is, so if you think of, why do I need to conquer everything? Well, if I start off from the place of we're oppressed and that we're surviving, in order to survive, I have to push back. If I don't recognize when I have established myself, I just keep pushing back. Pushing back and pushing, you know, because I don't know another way to do it. And so that way, eventually I become out of balance in a different way. So my first out of balance is oppressions in chains. If I push and push and push and push, I become the figure who enchains the other. You know, and so I become the thing I was originally fighting against. And that, you know, that's the other side of the coin.
And have people's perception, you know, imagining in that situation, Arthur saying, okay, actually, guys, I've had enough, I'm going to go home, I'm going to look after my home situation. Other people's perceptions of him really struck me, Ali, what you said last time about Tom saying to you, never be afraid to kind of completely leave everything behind in that place of other people's perceptions of if you do that, and there is a momentum that occurs, which even if in some way Alexander the Great or Arthur thinks like I want to go back,
How can we go back?
That's fine.
It's completely at a tangent, really, but Nigel Kennedy, when he was a, you know, a young genius and everything, he did all that, and then he stopped. He just stopped, and the whole structure all around him just collapsed, you know, media men, record company, everything, you know, and he just said, oh, put two fingers up and said, no, I'm not doing that anymore, you know, I'm doing, it was just a tremendously grounded and together thing for, he was still a very, very young man when he did that.
Jacinta Ardern did a similar thing, didn't she? Jacinta Ardern stopped as well, didn't she?
Yes.
I've not got it in me anymore.
Tom really was like that. He did this importantly numbers of times in his life, really. He just stopped and did something else. Because he wasn't attached to the form of things. And in a way, that's the kind of freedom he had somewhere, I think, it was the fruit of a lot of work on his part, but he was then, you know, it was almost seemingly effortless. I mean, it wasn't effortlessness in its creation, because it had taken him a lot of time and heartache and sadness to get to this place, but he then did have that fluidity. You know, so if I think about, you know, he walked away from the Servants of the Light organization because he felt it was kind of going in a completely wrong direction. And he didn't make a big fuss, he didn't take lots of people with him and create schisms and sort of in a followers around him. He just quietly resigned and sort of, and he and I went on to work together, in, you know, separately from that. I went with him because I had similar feelings about what was going on. And in a sense, it was that capacity that he had just to think, oh no, this is not right. So it's not right. However long I've been involved, and he'd been, you know, this has been such an important part of his life. He'd been one of the five founders of that organization, and it is by that point an international organization and doing lots of teaching work and whatever. And he just, without any fuss at all, he just quietly stepped away from it. And got interested in the work that he and I were doing together, which of course was much smaller scale and kind of indifferent.
But it's not just that, it's a thing of spiritual brotherhood and the huge, the fact that most people feel so isolated in their spirituality, so to move away from organisations is even bigger than moving away from, resigning from a company, for example.
Oh yeah, no, totally. No, of course it was a very big thing, you know, and it was a sort of something that, you know, he, having been very prominent and a teacher in that community, he literally walked away from it all, and in a way that was difficult. Now he could have, if he'd wanted to, I guess, created a schism, and so you'd have had two SOLs probably. But he wasn't interested in doing that. He was sort of interested in, you know, okay, letting people do whatever they need to do, what they wanted to do, what the person in charge of the organization mostly wanted to do and her husband wanted to do, but not what he wanted to do, and he didn't think it was right. So he just simply stepped to the side and just let it go its way, because he was going his way. And that wasn't because he was just passive. There had been a whole period of time of him arguing and challenging and fighting and struggling, and in the end coming to the place where he thought, okay, that's it. I think these moments are important, aren't they? Where we kind of, when I remember one of my moments was when I was working for the Department of Health. I probably told you all this before, but when I realised what an effective liar I was, and I was pushing some bloody policy. I can't remember what it was now exactly, but anyway, it wasn't. This was in the days of the Blair government, a very long time ago. And I was selling some policy to the social services directors and head to across England, and it was a very dubious policy. But I'd been told to talk it up to make it sound really attractive, and and I'm quite good with words, so I was doing all of that. And I was just looking out over the heads and watching them all nodding in agreement. And I just had a moment to think, oh my God, they believe me, oh my God. You know, and it's like that moment where you suddenly see a kind of future opening before you as the government's paid liar, you know, and kind of, oh, Rees is very good at this. Kind of, let's give him another dodgy policy. He seems to be quite good at persuading people that something terrible is good for them. And that was the moment where I just thought, okay, that's it, I'm done. I kind of stepped away and kind of, and I had an interesting thing happen to me at that point, because I also had my small developing, it's an interesting moment if I think about it, because I had a small developing psychotherapy practice, a part of me thinking, oh, I shall do that. But then a friend of mine offered me the opportunity to be on a mountain in South Africa for 6 months, which meant closing my practice down, leaving my work, and really sort of just, if you like, committing myself to the deep, really, and seeing what happens, and sort of, and with Ali's agreement, I did that, you know, and sort of, and so I just went off to South Africa and sat on a mountain with some really lovely people, and a lot of baboons, and with baboons and eagles and Cape vultures, and.
I nearly died in a fire.
I got to see an extraordinary, got to be part of one of those amazing African fires. You know, so it was and it was exactly the right thing I needed to do, really, and then be established.
So was it a spiritual retreat or a job?
No, it wasn't a job. It was it was an extraordinary thing. But I had this lovely friend called Kittisaro, who lives in the States. He's a remarkable man. He used to be a Buddhist monk, and he was one of the people that established Theravada Buddhism in Britain. And he and his partner, Teresa, was a nun, fell in love, and they disrobed because they fell in love, and then because they were always a challenge, they went to work in South Africa as Buddhist teachers and sort of, and he has a sort of remarkable karma, really, in that he met an old friend of his who was working for the De Beers diamond industry, therefore very rich, and he got given the mountain to use as a retreat centre. And this is in KwaZulu-Natal, and it's a Mofaleni mountain, which means rain mountain, rain shower mountain. So it's a very, very ancient, a sacred mountain, sacred to the Bushmen and later in particular. And he'd set up, it wasn't really a retreat centre properly, it was just a collection of huts, really. And so he asked me if I fancied going there and inaugurating it with him and his Tanisra and a couple of other people. And so there's about five of us. There were five of us. Sort of living on this mountain together for 6 months and meditating together every day and kind of and praying and walking them up the mountain and in a sense helping the soul of the retreat centre to come into being. And it was a really kind of a, and it came at such a precise moment, I think, for me, where I was in this sort of place of, oh my God, you know, rather like Brutus. It was my Brutus moment, where I'm on the sea. I know I've got to get away from, to be liberated from. But how the hell do I know what I'm going to do? And so I chucked everything up in the air and went to sit on this mountain and sort of and had a lot of remarkable experiences and. Came back and I mustn't tell this as though it's as if I'm makes me sound as though I really knew what I was doing. The other thing I did because I was scared was with a friend from Clydach who I was also working with, a friend from whom we set up a business, a terrible business consultancy, which I the frightened bit of me, so my own bit of the internal dialogue, had set up this thing was intended to give me security. I came back, and it was a disaster. It cost me a lot of money. It didn't give me any security at all. I hated it, and I got out of it just as soon, just as soon as I could. But it was a lesson of my own fear. Had I not done that, I'd have had more actual security if I'd not given into my own fear. Because what was really necessary was I just needed to clear the decks, then come home, and then see what happens, really, which is what I actually did, in fact. And it was shortly after that I started, restarted my practice. I started working in Israel and teaching at the Karuna Institute, and the rest of it is history, really. But these moments of choice somewhere that came upon us, and what do we choose? And these moments of choice are difficult moments, really. I didn't want to be away from Ali, and I didn't want to, but I knew that this was something I needed to do. And it was in the year, it was also in the year 2000, so it was the year of the millennium. It was the sort of, it was in the spring of the millennium, and sort of and so it was, the stars aligned. But of course, I could have done something else. I did a job offer. I did other things I could have done, and I was giving up this very prestigious, very, very well-paid job, and more than I've ever earned since. And I had to deal with my desire for power and influence, because, people say, well, Reese is good, he's a good, effectively they say he's a good liar. They don't say you're a good liar. They say, actually, you do this very well, you present policies very well. Yes, it's all done very, very flatly.
You're a rubbish liar.
I am normally a rubbish liar. In that setting, and that's where I got that kind of audience. No, I can't lie in normal circumstances. How I need lying for the government is a different matter.
So.
There, I'm good at it, so it's a sort of...
Lying for money is easier.
Lying for money rather than lying personally, no, totally.
I mean, you're a great storyteller, and to sell something, it's you have to tell a story.
No, that's
it's
it.
It's not personal lying, it's storytelling.
No, exactly. It's that storyteller in me that actually really worked in that kind of setting. And I always remember this bloody nodding heads. Because I knew it was a load of rubbish. What I say was a load of rubbish. I was thinking... And I was embarrassed to do it, because I was thinking, oh, Christ, they're going to give me a hell of a time, because surely they're going to see that what I'm presenting, because what I was actually presenting is if they're getting given something more when actually something has been taken away. And I was still thinking, surely that's not going to work. And it was the watching it work that did me in. Mm-hmm. Where you're thinking, oh my God.
Found your inner Samuel. Found your inner Samuel.
Yeah.
So you didn't say... At the end of your storytelling, hi guys, this is complete rubbish. I've just lied to you the whole time.
I couldn't possibly have done that, because I'd have got into a lot of trouble if I said that. No, so I'd rather slip quietly away, thanks very much. But I don't, no, God, no, I wasn't going to do that. Because you're part of it, you're caught up in it. So you're sort of, you are the, yes, no, I would, God, no, I wouldn't have done that. It wouldn't have been me at all. But learning to find a way to step away from it, and people were really shocked that I stepped away. I kept getting offered other things, and couldn't understand. I didn't want to do it, and particularly when they said, well, "What are you going to do?" I think I'm going to sit on a mountain in South Africa for 6 months. These are not people that will understand the concept of spiritual retreat, really.
I think that's a really good example of where we get confused with. So I think that's a really good example of sovereignty being the courage to step out of a collective current.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Whereas I think what's happening, the way the word sovereignty is used in not here, but like in the media now, it's as if it's something that we all do together because we're owed it somehow. Kind of like part of this sovereign land or something like that. It's not the individual courage to go, actually this is going in the wrong direction.
Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely right. I think that's the point. So that sense of verticality and connection to what is true for us, I think, is the and having the courage to kind of pursue that is pivotal somewhere. Although, of course, you know, in the moment you don't actually feel it. Well, at least in my experience, you don't feel you're being brave. You feel like it's that sense of alignment itself that holds you. Mm. I think that's the interesting thing. It's not like white dive to scuba about me. There's a certain amount of that because you're scared. Like, you know, obviously I was scared I wouldn't earn any money again, really, because not only was I getting rid of this very lucrative job, I had this early growing practice which I suddenly just closed down and just got and didn't know if I could start it up again. So I sort of, and then I wouldn't be earning any money at all for 6 months, and so I had to kind of, and had enough money to leave with Ali, so our bills got paid for 6 months, and I was paying my bills at South Africa, and then I didn't know what would happen next, and sort of, but something in me, it's that deeper sense, maybe we call it the soul quality, or that the holding that comes from that place of alignment, that then holds us and carries us. Mm.
Mm. I think that's where the real courage is, when you feel that you feel afraid and like you don't really know what you're doing, but you just know you have to do it.
Yeah. Mm. Well, I think that's it, in a way. That's the fundamental thing, I think, really, and that's the key thing. Once you've got that, and then it really is about then cooperating with mystery and a mysterious and unfolding process. And I think we keep coming back to this point time and time again. You know, we get up in the morning, what do we meet? What's happening to us? And, you know, it's sort of, particularly these days, when we're at the world seems to assault us with all kinds of horrible images. And so that sense of taking a breath, connecting to mystery, what is the way the world is going? If you go back to we have no certainty at all about the way the world is trying to unfold itself, but I have faith in a way in the mystery of the process. You know, in a way it's that place of that, when we get present, when we align in that way, no matter how difficult things might look personally, or that there's something about the simplicity that happens if we can let ourselves do that. You know, one of the things about living with cancer is obviously I've got something going on in my body that may be the thing that kills me, or something else might kill me. A bit of a race, really, with the different things that are going on in me, really, which, you know, this one's going to get me. It could be a car, you know, that's about something else could get me that I haven't even thought about, or I don't know about. But there's something about when you live with that, and of course, one of the things when you live with something like this, you've caught up in a magical system that reminds you. You know the way the Roman emperors used to have this, if they were on their triumphs, you'd have a slave hitting you on the head and reminding you that you're mortal. Yeah. Well, being involved in an ongoing way with the NHS is rather like that. You know, those of us who know that, you get on with your life, then the letter, NHS letter comes, fucking hell, I've now got to go and be tested, and oh my God, thou art mortal, Ian, what's the test going to reveal, and kind of, and so far so good, touch wood. But it's, one of the things it teaches you is to locate yourself very simply in the unfolding mystery of the process. And I think that's that part of sovereignty is somewhere. And it's the thing that interrupts the internal dialogue. Problem with Arthur is the momentum, and you're right to say the momentum of the people around him. He cannot interrupt that, so that's why he spins out further and further out. And then the thing he was trying to do in the beginning, which was to protect and hold the peace, the peace of Britain and the restore the civilization, in a sense to keep Camelot in existence, falls apart. And that's why it only goes on for a short period of time, because he could not find the centre point somewhere.
Even though it was right there.
Yeah, that's right. So if he had simply stopped, right? If he had stopped when he... Because you get this moment where he's restored everything, he's summoned the kings to him at Caerleon, they've established themselves. There's a point in Geoffrey's story, actually, everything is, it goes all right, until he decides to overcome Rome. So even though he has, I think, overextended himself, it's still all in balance. See, they all come, he's crowned again as the High King. But the thing that undoes him is he wants to be emperor. And he's insulted by Lucius Tiberius demanding tribute. And that's the thing that takes him beyond the boundaries. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that means that Mordred and his queen get together and destroys everything from underneath him.
This reminds me of what I've experienced with a lot of other people and in myself, you know, facing particular things in one's life that one's working with. And feeling like you're on a roller coaster. Oh, it feels so good today, and I'm really committed. Oh, I'm down.
Yeah.
And the going with it as it's like such an everyday gift, isn't it?
Yeah.
As opposed to some of the big stories that you've been saying.
But the big stories, in a sense, help us, I think, because they reflect into the reality of these stories. Why are we even bothering with them at one level? But partly because they reflect into our everyday struggles. So we think of ourselves everyday sovereignty and everyday illumination, you could say. Right? So everyday illumination would be about what happens when I get up in the morning, what happens when I feel scared, what happens when I feel tense or worried or down or kind of, and it's the working with that that is the everyday establishment of sovereignty. And the key thing here somewhere is the great danger is to abandon ourselves into the idol, into the place of fear, into the place of constriction. Now these things will come up in us, these old voices always come up in us. They're the attackers that say we're fake, we're liars, we're cheats, we're bad people of various kinds. And then it's not about exiling them, it's a bit like, okay, here we are, my old companions, back again, okay, here we are. But back with the breath, back with the sense of body, back with the alignment with the center point and the archangels, and really gathering them into the center point. Just like in the story of Arthur, the robber barons are gathered and have to swear in, so they are included within the sense of the round table, and that has the living grail at its center. And just as we finish, really, that when we did the meditation just before the tea break, that sense of being as vast as the angels, right, and that our presence is different from angels, but in our own way we are both small and vast. And that sense of that kind of being the pillar that connects the worlds, being the link point, that's the fundamental human task. Now that happens in everyday events. That happens in when we just remember ourselves. It can be in ecstatic meditations or big things that happen, but it is almost just the affirmation of here I am. Here I am. Here we are. Together. Yes. We align together. So with that in mind, let's just, as we could, come to our end. So just close our eyes together and be together. And be with each other. And be with the archangels. and just feel those protective presences gathered around us, and be with all the events of the weekend. Seems to go more and more quickly every time we have one, to me at least. But just gathering whatever we have found. With these images of kings and magicians and gnomes. Dryads, whatever we have found, letting them all come together. And just being with us. As we enter into the state of Anuki, I am. Sivaviyal, we thank you. Go in peace. Oriel, we thank you. Go in peace. Gabrielle, we thank you. Go in peace. Mikael, we thank you. Go in peace. Raphael, we thank you. Go in peace. Let us all go in peace.